Obituary.
Obituary. Willie Mays, possibly the best baseball player ever, died on June 18th, aged 93.
Around 9 o'clock in the morning, a tap would come at his window. Outside his house in St. Nicholas Place in Harlem milled a group of grinning boys. They carried mop handles and a pink bouncing ball, all the equipment they needed. The street and the parked cars would provide the rest. What they wanted was to play stickball, and he was only too eager to join them. He'd play for an hour, morning or evening, as his job allowed. Soon he was crouching, swinging the stick, just an ordinary man in a polo shirt and trousers. But when he made contact, he whacked the ball so hard that it went for three or four sewers or three or four city blocks. Because, after all, he was Willie Mays, then the star of the New York Giants. Playing stickball taught him how to hit curveballs. You never knew how the surface of the street might skew that high, wild bounce. Apart from that, though, he did not have much to learn. His father, nicknamed Cat for his slinky prowess on the field, had played baseball between jobs down near Birmingham, Alabama. It was he who taught him how to be a center fielder and to stick with the game. At 16, playing practically barefooted, he already knew exactly what he had to do. His body was built for baseball, strong, sinewy, and graceful, like his dad's. He could hit a ball out of the park, defend, outsmart anyone, and catch mostly anything. Easy. That happy certainty lasted years. The statistics followed. Over his 22-year major league career, 6 years with the Giants in New York, 15 more when they moved west in 1958 to become the San Francisco Giants, two with the New York Mets, he stacked up 3,293 hits, 660 home runs, 339 steals, a .301 batting average, two National League Most Valuable Player awards, and 12 Gold Gloves. 10 of those hits, all that were recorded, were added in 2024 from his time in 1948-50 with the Birmingham Black Barons in the segregated Negro League. He could have scored even higher without Army service, which he mostly spent playing baseball anyway to entertain the troops. Entertainment was the thing. Statistics didn't lodge in his brain. Besides, a few other players surpassed him in the numbers game, and it never mattered as much as the way he played, with sheer joy. His philosophy was, they throw the ball, I hit it, they hit the ball, I catch it. If he did that as well as he could lead by example and make the people around him play better. When younger players asked him for advice, as they often did, he would tell them first to enjoy themselves. He didn't smoke, drink, or fool around with women because baseball was the most fun he could think of. His pink Lincoln Continental and his smile said it all. He also had ways of making his job even more fun for fans, breaking late on a ball to bait a runner before speeding up at just the right time, stealing bases on the riskiest dare in heroic explosions of dust, and wearing a cap one size too small for him, which, at exciting moments, would blow right off his head. It blew off, predictably, in his best play of all, in the 1954 World Series, when the Giants were facing the Cleveland Indians. Vic Wirtz of Cleveland powered the ball to the back of the ground, 460 feet or so, and Willie Mays ran, raced, and right at the wall snagged it with one of his famous basket catches over his left shoulder. It was known ever after as the catch and brought the crowd to its feet. But he knew he had made better ones than that. For a start, he was sure he would get it. He often had a strange sort of premonition about that. Lying down at night, watching TV, suddenly a fly ball would come out to him, and he'd know how to deal with it. The next day, he would recognize that very ball because he had seen it the night before. But second, where the catch was concerned, that was not the most important bit of the play. The vital part was to instantly do a 360, whirl around, cap off, and hurl the ball to the infield so the runners at the bases couldn't score. He did it, and the Giants won the series. Now, that was truly great. Being light-hearted was not always easy. When he signed for the New York Giants in 1950, he went initially to Trenton, New Jersey, in the Interstate League. From being a happy teenager in the Birmingham Black Barons, where they were all brothers and everyone took care of him, he was suddenly the only black player around. As he moved higher, too, the pitching got fiercer, and he knew no one. His nickname, the Say Hey Kid, came from his clumsy attempts to break in and make friends. In the smaller towns, people said openly that they didn't like him playing, but he had a neat answer for that. If they mocked him, he'd hit the ball further. After a few nights of that, they would be applauding him. Racism followed him, sadly, to the West Coast. Two things surprised him about San Francisco. First, how cold and windy Candlestick Park was, so much so that he had to rub himself with hot oil before he played. But second, that he could not buy a house in elegant Sherwood Forest because the white neighbours objected. They backed down, but after 2 years, he moved 3,000 miles to the East Coast, just north of New York. The city had always welcomed him with open arms. So, though he did not like to be traded, he was content to end his career there with the New York Mets. He hardly ever spoke out about civil rights. Off the field, he was shy, and it wasn't his thing. Other black baseball greats, especially Hank Aaron and Jackie Robinson, criticized him for that. But in Alabama, he had learned to keep his head down and his mouth shut. His way of joining in the fight when he retired was again to lead by example, this time by giving his money away. He gave his dentist $12,000 for a new chair, a young woman $10,000 to clear her credit card debts, and set up the Say Hey Foundation to do what he could for underprivileged youngsters. This, he wanted to say, was how black folk responded to prejudice, whether by good works or by playing ball, they changed hatred to joy.